right now, and it's not true just under Xi Jinping, but I think it's becoming clearer, there aren't these countervailing forces. And I think in the United States, it's very, very important right now that there is the ability for the press to publish things that the president would rather have them not publish, which increasingly can't be done by the press in China, even to the extent that it could recently. It's important that there be room for different kinds of opinions. That doesn't mean that authoritarian figures aren't often very, very popular. Authoritarian figures that are now reviled at their time had large popular constituencies as well. So I don't think the fact that a lot of people think a leader is good means that that leader is ultimately good. But I do think I think it could be useful if we thought a little bit less about elections as the marker of different societies, and we thought more about things like the press being able to call a leader to account and a court being able to call police to account. And I think that's something that is worrisome within China, and there's the possibility of things happening that will make it a source of friction within the country again.
Well, at least one American thought it was the end of term limits was not a bad idea, right?
Yes. Yes.
He heard about it, he said it's something to think about here.
Yes, that's right.
Others? David?
Mm-hmm. So, I don't know if we need microphones in here.
Mm-hmm. We're recording.
Oh, you okay. So
you don't mind being quoted, do you?
Well, fascinating discussion. I can't wait to get a copy of the new edition. Maybe I'll pick one up at AES this weekend. But as someone who's wrestled with China's future myself, I have a couple of questions that kind of flow onto that. When I was writing my book, China's Future, I kept asking myself, I wish the historians would help us political scientists and contemporary events people, quite seriously, because there are patterns, dynastic patterns. And so that's my first question, Jeff, in particular. Where are we, or where is China, in the dynastic cycle? What elements do you see today that parallel some stage or another, particularly if it's a declining stage? I have a colleague at Peking University, for example, I saw recently, and he told me he'd been out to the party school recently to visit a retired historian. And I asked my friend, what was this man talking about? He said he was talking about the dynastic cycle and how many elements of China today are present. And he said, this retired man, there are 12 elements of a declining, every Chinese declining dynasty. And so my friend said, well, where are we on the of the 12, 7, 8, 6, and the man said 14. But that's a serious question. I mean, do you see parallels with Ming Qing in particular? And then the second question was spurred by Maura's discussion of internet censorship. So when systems decay, communists or autocratic systems in general, but I don't know if you've seen the film The Lives of Others about East Germany and the GDR and the Stasi agent. So one thing that happens is not just corruption within the regime, it's the enforcers of the regime's writ, the apparatchiks, who begin to get, you know, alienated from their enforcing job, and it cracks from within. So do you see any evidence of all these, you know, God knows how many enforcers of the digital space China has, but of the NGO space? I mean, they throw so much human power and electronic power at control. My question is, do we see any elements? We always look for NGOs or, you know, elements in the civil society who are opposing the regime. So my question is, do you see anything within the regime itself, the control apparatchiks, that might suggest a meltdown from within?
I'd almost rather answer that one than have you do the dynastic cycle.
Yeah, it's a very big question.
I mean, I only have a little answer about the internet side, which is, when we were talking in another setting about does Xi Jinping have a real personality cult? In some ways, you know, it's hard to know, like, what do people believe? But we do know that there are cracks in the censorship system. We know very clearly by one thing the China Digital Times outfit out of Berkeley that Xiaoqiang and others run, they continually post what they call Ministry of Truth directives, mini-true. And they put out lists of what is banned and when and what the directives are that are going out that say these are this is how you should handle these issues. Those are NABU internal circulation only documents, and they are regularly coming out. So there clearly are people at some level within the censorship mechanism that say we're doing this, but we don't believe in it. There was not that it's a perfect analogy. I was heard an interview with Masha Gessen recently on the New Yorker Radio Hour, and she was talking about in the Soviet system, one of her grandmothers had been a kind of radical figure, and another grandmother had been a censor, and that this but they she admired them both, and you know, and she was talking about what they both did, and the one who became and the obvious thing would be to think the one who became a censor was, you know, a complete believer in the regime, but not at all. The one who became a censor had been a school teacher, and or was going to be a school teacher and then became a censor. And she said, because if I was a school teacher, I'd have to be actively inculcating a lie to a young generation. If I'm doing a censor, I'm just doing what any functionary would do. I'll be censoring the same things anybody would do. So there may be lots of people within the system who aren't actively, you know, but we don't know. I mean, there are tests that'll come out. There are things that tested, that test regimes. I mean, Chernobyl was this incredible test for the Soviet. There could be things like, and I think potentially the earthquake in 2008 and how the government responded was a test of sorts to it. Just briefly on the dynastic thing. So that's funny. I like the 14 factors there. Until then, my favorite thing about this was we gave a talk in when the second edition came out. We gave a talk for the Foreign Correspondents Club in Beijing, and it was largely journalists and some diplomats and some business people, and we were talking about parallels with the anti-corruption drive and other things. We were going back to the Mao period, to Deng Xiaoping period, and then thought we were going way back to the Chiang Kai-shek period. And then this guy put up his hand and said, what do you think about this maybe being like a late dynastic reform system moment? And he was a journalist, Anthony Kuhn of NPR, who's the son of Chinggis, the late Chinggis historian, Philip Kuhn. And so Anthony grew up with, you know, he's a journalist covering the contemporary thing, and he was thinking then, what if we thought in these dynastic terms? But I think you put your finger on one thing, and actually, David, one of your books is particularly good about this. The degree to which the current regime is a diagnostic regime studies very much the scenarios, how it might collapse. So one of the things that's different is I don't think, if it is kind of like a dynasty, it's one that's very intensely looking at that and trying to figure out what do we need to do. So when I say this is kind of like 1898, that's nothing that isn't already being discussed within China. And people saying, okay, but maybe it's like 1898, we're moving against reform, but we're stronger than China was then, so we won't have the kind of external force. And the literature about revolutions, the historians of revolutions, used to focus a lot on things like ideas, the spread of ideas, or other things, and those still matter. And sometimes way back they focus more on great men, or you know, there. But then later, some of it is that there are also structural factors within a country, and then there's the international setting. So when something collapsed or not, maybe that there's some other factor, and that happens sometimes with dynasties as well. So it's just another way of saying, you know, there are so many factors that are beyond it, beyond what the regime can control. And the things that are under the regime control, the regime is trying very hard to figure out how it can alter the variables. And it does that by looking at the Soviet Union's collapse, but it also does it by looking at dynastic collapses.
Okay, so Jeff just did a great job of answering both your questions. I'll just add, in a way relating to both of them, is that I think among the sort of China-watching scholarly journalist community in the United States and Europe over the past couple of years, we've seen this ongoing argument over, is Xi Jinping strong or weak? You know, does this move to consolidate power, is this increased censorship and repression of civil society an expression of his strength, that he's cracking down on these things, or is it that he's actually very weak and paranoid and this is his way of trying to crack down on dissent so that he can, you know, become stronger? And I don't think it needs to be, you know, this, I think this discussion is getting kind of out of hand and unproductive in a way. Personally, I don't think that he's weak, though, that, you know, I don't think he would have been able to make the moves that he's had. Certainly getting his name into the state constitution, I don't think is a sign of a weak ruler. And so I think these sorts of discussions about, you know, the importance, the significance of these moves against civil society and dissent and so forth, I don't see them as anymore as expressions of weakness. I think early on in his first term, you could have maybe made that argument better, but I think over the past 5 years, we've just seen him grow stronger and stronger. As for cracks within the system, I mean, it's tough, and our understanding of how, especially internet censorship works, it's becoming increasingly automated. And so, yes, you might have someone who's programming the automation to demonstrate cracks, to let certain words go through or so forth. But as it becomes more automated, I think we're going to see fewer and fewer of those cracks. I mean, it is kind of amazing right now, the speed at which things get taken down.
Dachi?
This is a fascinating discussion. I'm a historian teaching many students of international affairs, so the question how history can help us understand the present and even future is very much on our mind. We have a course here for graduate students called The Issue of History in International Affairs. There are several sessions going on, and I'm teaching one of them. And there are several questions I'm wrestling with and I have no good answer. Namely, you know, many of the authors we read talk about use and abuse of history, as if there's a clear demarcation. On this side is abuse, good use, and the other is abuse. What's your opinion on this? Like, learning lessons from the past, you're referring to, you know, communist leadership in China, somehow smartly learning some useful lessons for their regime, right? So, I mean, in relation to David's question, it may be that Chinese leaders or those enforcers realize, yes, the current limitation on freedom is bad, but what's the alternative? It could unleash chaos that we know that happened in China this period, that period. So they may be drawing different kind of history from where we are. So that's one question. Another also broad question is, would you say there are certain countries that somehow are particularly adept at learning history or applying history or looking back in history than others? I mean, sometimes people say, okay, United States is only, what, 200 some year old, China is, what, several thousand years, so naturally it's in China's political culture. I'm not sure quite about this, but at the same time, I feel there's something to it, because when the government uses term like, you know, Yishi Weijian, history is a mirror, somehow it resonates, you know, even in the public, even though, of course, the lesson they try to, you know, promote is very self-serving, but still has some kind of resonance, as compared to maybe the United States, I don't know.
Those are great cluster of questions.
Yeah, I mean, certainly when you're talking about the uses and abuses of history, I think the biggest abuse or the biggest problem that we might encounter when we're looking at China is the government, the Chinese Communist Party's attempt to control the historical narrative and control what people know about history. So over the last few years, we've increasingly seen references to what they call historical nihilism, that, you know, anyone who says something against our official version of history is wrong, and they are trying to undermine the Chinese Communist Party. We're also seeing increasingly historical archive access being cut off, not just to scholars within China, but to foreign scholars as well. And so I think, you know, it's important, obviously, I'm a historian, it's very important to know history, but to also understand all of history, not just one official version of it, and not just focusing on the things that the government wants people in China. You know, right now, if you want to do research about the Sino-Japanese War, you can find tons of documents because that's something that the government wants to encourage research on. They want people to document Japanese abuses during wartime. Whereas if you want to investigate, you know, anything that happened during the Mao period, of course, that's kind of a non-starter, especially in some archives. And the Ministry of Foreign Affairs archive was closed for a very long time, and I think it still is. Okay, I heard for a while they might be reopening it, maybe, but it's essentially closed. Yeah.
Is the number two archive?
The number two archive is limited availability.
Qing archives are open, but
yeah,
I've heard that provincial archives are now restricting access or being closed. Municipal archives, of course, the party archives have never been open.
Right. So, I mean, I think that's the big problem in China is that, yes, it's important to know history, and history is very important to the Chinese Communist Party, but the grip that it's trying to keep on that history and on discussions of history is problematic.
So I think another thing is just to break history up into a variety of categories. So I think lived experience history can have enormous importance, and even lived experience, and then sometimes memory, but there's also what people talk about as prosthetic memory. It's something you didn't actually experience, but you've been inculcated with so much that it has the power of memory. And we've seen, I mean, you work on these kinds of things as well, that there's some more intense anti-Japanese feeling at times among people who are of a later generation that actually went through the war, but have been exposed to continual filmic representations. And Richard McGregor, in his new book on US, China, and Japan, was giving the example of, like, there wasn't that much talk or representations at some point of Japanese atrocities. There was more focus on American atrocities, and then there was more on Japanese. And then just he went through the incredible proliferation of films about Japanese atrocities, which some of which were so outlandish. He said one has a character saying, "The Japanese were so cruel, they killed my grandfather when he was only 7 years old,"
right.
Which, you know, logically has problems with it. But so you have lived memory, I think, is very important. And I think lived memory, history, you have a lot of people in China who lived through the Cultural Revolution. And the problem is that doesn't just give one lesson. So you could say one lesson of living through the Cultural Revolution is don't have a personality cult again, ever. And that's one lesson you could get. Another is don't have a period where there's a lot of room for factional struggles. That's a different lesson you could do. But memory of that and a desire for order and a fear of chaos, I don't think is about age-old, centuries-old Chinese cultural hardwiring. Because there are Chinese traditional novels that celebrate the world being turned upside down, but I think having lived through the Cultural Revolution could make you allergic to a period of upheaval. Same way, you know, living through the Depression had decades and decades long of sort of resonances for some Americans. And then, you know, wow, history. So I think in terms of which culture, which countries have, this is so complicated. I think it also has to do with whether we think of history in purely national terms or something else. So for example, Henry Kissinger in On China, which I reviewed kind of roughly as a bad fat book with a better thin one struggling to get out, because I liked his memoirs of it. Mm. But he talked, when he went into sort of broad discussions of China, I thought it was a real problem. One thing he said was, China, even under Mao, so Mao was rejecting the old order, but it's such a history-obsessed culture that Mao could talk about a battle that took place 2,000 years ago, and everybody in the room would know about, because China cares so much about its history. Well, fine, but in America, of course, you can't say something that happened 2,000 years ago, but in a room full of very ahistorical generals, you can say it's like crossing the Rubicon. And everybody knows exactly what that means. Or you can say it's like Brutus. You know, are you acting like Brutus to Caesar? So in a sense, the Chinese Communist Party is claiming everything of the Chinese cultural past, almost like somebody in the West claiming all of the Western tradition and going, which, no, I mean, we still think it's meaningful that somebody talks about Thucydides, you know. We're not just only aware of a kind of national history. So that's one of the confusions, I think, is that China is in some ways more like a continent or more like a kind of civilizational thing than a nation state. But sometimes the history is the one or the other. Zhou Enlai said, and Kissinger mentions this, even when he's talking about how China has this long-term thing. At one point, I think he has Zhou Enlai saying to a visiting American, well, you're from an old country. You were founded a couple of hundred years ago. We're a young country. We were just established 20 years ago, thinking about 1949 as the start of a new country. So do you call that a new country, as you could? Is the People's Republic of China an old country or a young country? You can do it either way.
Yes.
Thank you. I'm learning a lot about China. Well, Jisoo came from history department. So I think one of the continuing themes in this discussion is about censorship and control in China. I have a question about the current state of activism, I want to hear more about activism in China right now, I guess. So, for example, if we were to compare with South Korea also went through this dictatorship period, and there was a lot of resistance from students, and students were the ones who led democratization movement in South Korea. I'm just wondering, because you were mentioning about the feminist, the five feminists,
yeah.
and some sorts of activism going there. I was wondering China obviously has that Tiananmen experience, but what kind of resistance are there? I mean, yes, there is definitely that, you know, control and censorship, but for example, with the rise of internet in South Korea, it was the youth, the younger generation that really changed the election culture back in the 2000s, and that really shifted to liberal movement. I mean, I don't expect to see that in China, but I'm curious just to know what kinds of resistance are there from younger generation youth? Because I'm just wondering whether, you know, just Chinese are being more submissive to just, you know, this government, or I'm imagining there must be some sorts of resistance too, although it's a small, you know, group of people. So I'm just curious to know more about what kind of activism is going on.
Can I talk briefly?
Yeah, please.
So I do think one very small pocket that we've seen more recently is the Me Too movement against sexual harassment in China. So it's not like it is, you know, in the United States. It's really been about people in the entertainment industry and politicians. Of course, politicians in China, that's a non-starter to try to talk about sexual harassment in that area, since you'd be talking about Communist Party members. But we have seen it, again, very, very small. I'm not trying to imply that this is a really widespread large scale movement. But we have seen some examples of people talking about experiences of sexual harassment and sharing their stories on the internet. In fact, the hashtag MeToo and both the English and the Chinese versions were censored. And so in response, people started to use a picture of a rice bowl and a rabbit together. They were using the emojis because they're homophones in Chinese for Me Too. So that worked for a little while, and then the censors started censoring them as well.
So they're being creative.
They're being very creative, yeah, very responsive. And the area where we've seen probably the most effect is that there have been a couple of cases of university professors being relieved of their positions when stories about sexual harassment came out. I literally think maybe two cases. But this is one area where you do see a little bit of youth activism and a real effect on it. But Jeff can speak more broadly.
So I think in a long historical contrast, and Elizabeth Perry wrote about this in a working paper, from 1898 up until 1989, you could count on the fact that when a sort of important event happened, there would be some kind of discussion on campuses. And during the Hundred Flowers movement, during all sorts of periods. Now, the campuses are incredibly controlled spaces, so you don't have, this was a rare counter thing, which is important.
And on the internet, not actually
right,
on campuses.
Right, so campuses themselves are very controlled. I think, again, the Communist Party knows its own history, knows how important campuses were in their own rise and in other settings as well. But it's also really dangerous to count out any generation of youth, I think. And, you know, we've seen this in America, clearly, when the millennials are all self-involved, or post-millennials are totally, and now they're very active when something triggers it. If the current generation of youth are much more engaged with global popular culture, if there were a complete cutoff from all Western-style entertainment, there would be pushback. Not maybe it doesn't matter if there's, you know, Facebook and Twitter, but if you really felt like you were not able to be part of the world that young people, there would be. There's also a lot of concern about the environment, and there could be a way. You don't necessarily see youth, but you do see younger faces at environmental protests to the extent that those are still there. You certainly see the tradition of what Chinese youth activism was alive in Hong Kong. Still, people taking very bold moves there. But when you mentioned Korea, one of the many things that are said on the internet that then get swept away is references to, are we living in West Korea? West North Korea, in some very ways? So that's a way to do that, and it's a relevant one.
That's
and
the
the creativity is just amazing. For a while, you couldn't mention the June, well, you can't mention the June 4th massacre online, can't mention June 4th, so people began to mention the date May 35th until the censors caught up with that. And so there's enormous creativity, there's enormous desire to be part of a wider world among young Chinese. There's no place for that, very few places for that to go. Energy right now, but we shouldn't figure that the end of these stories has come.
All right. Well, if we're coming to an end of our session, in any case, clearly we've had an absolutely fascinating presentation, and you raised so many important and deep questions that are going to continue to be hanging in the air for us. So
thank you all
hopefully
for the questions and the moderating. Yeah.
Hopefully you'll write a fourth edition, and I encourage everyone to grab one of these on your way out.
They have a discount code on them.
Yeah.
Okay,
so
make sure
you
to get
should really grab one.
Yeah.
All right, so please join me in thanking Jeffrey and Mara.
Thank you.